Welcome to this Middle East Forum event. My name is Scott Rosenblum. First, a few words about the Middle East Forum. The Forum's mission is to define and promote American interests in the Middle East and help the United States defend itself against Islamist threats. The Forum accomplishes its mission intellectually by providing context, insights, and policy recommendations through its publications. Operationally, by exerting an active influence on the course of events through its projects, philanthropically, by distributing over $2 million annually, helping researchers, writers, investigators, and activists around the world. Specifically, some of the Forum's activities, which many of you already know, but I'll repeat them, include the Washington Project, which monitors and influences U.S. policy in the Middle East, the Legal Project, which protects free speech about Islam and related topics and protects writers and researchers from frivolous lawsuits and intimidation, the Campus Watch, which monitors extremism and bias in Middle East studies, Islamist Watch, which monitors nonviolent Islamist activities, and the Middle East Quarterly, a policy-oriented journal which provides cutting-edge information on the Middle East. The Forum's websites have received millions of visits, and I invite you to visit our website, meforum.org, for further information about the Forum's activities. I also hope you'll consider supporting the Forum financially. As a not-for-profit organization with a staff of 18, the Forum relies on tax-deductible contributions which support a well-managed and lean but highly productive and effective organization. Your contributions will be put to excellent use. As we begin, please switch off all cell phones and pagers. We ask that you hold comments and questions until after the formal presentation ends. The question and answer period will be facilitated by MEF board member Roger Gerber. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker Michael Totten. Michael Totten is a foreign correspondent and foreign policy analyst who has reported from the Middle East, the Balkans, and the Caucasus. His work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Jerusalem Post Commentary, Beirut's Daily Star, and the Australian edition of Newsweek. Mr. Totten is the author of The Road to Fatima Gate, The Beirut Spring, The Rise of Hezbollah, and The Iranian War Against Israel, which is currently number one on Amazon's list of books on Lebanon. Fatima Gate benefits from his experiences and interviews in Lebanon and Israel during the 2005 Cedar Revolution and the devastating 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah, and Hezbollah's slow motion but violent assault on Lebanon's elected government. Today, Mr. Totten will explain why Lebanon matters, especially in light of the massive unrest roiling the Middle East. And now, please welcome Michael Totten.
Hello. Thanks for coming, everybody. Can everybody hear me all right in the back? Yeah? Okay. So we have an hour. I've got prepared remarks for the first half, and we can open up the second half for discussion. See if I can raise this thing. Can you still hear me? I don't have to lean into it? Okay. All right, so as the Arab Spring, we're calling the Arab Spring, sweeps through the region, toppling governments in Tunisia and Egypt and threatening those in Libya, Yemen, and Syria, you might ask if tiny little Lebanon even matters. Surprisingly, it has been rather quiet lately, a bit like Iraq. I mean, both Iraq and Lebanon have been the two most unstable countries in the region for quite some time. And all of a sudden, they're both fairly quiet. And Iraq, I think, might actually be okay. It's hard to say, but Lebanon, any perceived quietness or stability in Lebanon is, I think, an illusion. That the country is in a holding pattern right now and that it's getting ready to blow. Again, tragically, it is a place, and has been for decades now, where the Middle East fights its wars and settles its conflicts. It has been since the 1970s. And the key to understanding why Lebanon is a place where the Middle East fights its wars can be found in its demographics. There are officially 18 different religious communities in Lebanon. If you count up all the small ones, there's a few hundred Jews, a handful of Alawites, the Druze, and a bunch of little Christian denominations. But basically, the country is divided roughly into threes, with one third being Christian, another third being Sunni Muslim, and a final third Shia Muslim. And nobody's exactly sure which of these three sects is the largest, because there hasn't been an official census taken in the country since the 1930s. Everybody's afraid of what the numbers are going to say. The Christians used to be a slight majority, and they've been losing population relative to the Muslims in Lebanon, partly because their birth rate is smaller, but also because during the Civil War, it was easier for them to emigrate. Most of them came to the United States. And it was harder for the Sunnis and for the Shias to leave. And the Shias, until recently, have had a much larger birth rate. So the Shias like to say that they're not the majority, but the largest group. The Christians like to say that they're the largest group. Nobody actually knows. But basically, you've got the country divided into threes. One-third Christian, one-third Sunni, one-third Shia. And these three communities compete with each other for power. They usually do it non-violently through the political process, but sometimes they do it violently. And all of them have been willing to accept outside foreign assistance in return for acting as a proxy for foreign powers. And they'll do this because it helps them get a leg up against the competing communities inside the country. And this is basically what has been tearing the country apart. You've got the Sunnis right now who are politically aligned with the Arab world as a whole, not Syria, because Syria is aligned with Iran, but the Sunnis of Lebanon are basically in line with the Arab world, and to a lesser extent, somewhat nominally, with the West. The Shia community politically is aligned with Iran, and the Christians are divided, as they usually are, but their default position for the Christians of Lebanon is to be pro-Western, and sometimes they have even been pro-Israel. And there are a lot more of the Lebanese Christians than they will ever admit are quietly, secretly pro-Israel today, although they're not politically and not openly, because it's very dangerous for them to be pro-Israel. I mean, supporting Israel in any way whatsoever in Lebanon is a red line. But if I get a Maronite Christian telling me privately, maybe one-third to one-half are either, if not necessarily pro-Israel, they're at least not anti-Israel in quite the same way that the Arab world is as a whole. The country really started going downhill in the 1970s when Yasser Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organization was exiled from Jordan to Lebanon. As Arafat and the PLO waged a war against the Jordanian monarchy, tried to overthrow the king of Jordan, and the Jordanians responded ruthlessly and exiled PLO. And the PLO set up shop in Lebanon for two reasons. One, because Lebanon borders Israel, like Jordan did, so it was a convenient location for the PLO to wage its war against Israel. And the second reason that they chose Lebanon was because the Sunnis of Lebanon welcomed the Palestinians. The Christians of Lebanon did not, and the Shias of Lebanon did not, but the Sunnis did. And Lebanon has a weak state by design, and they can't really get much done in the government unless all three communities agree. And so the Christians wanted the government to shut Arafat down, but the Sunnis welcomed him, so there was an impasse. And meanwhile, Arafat set up basically his own little state within a state, with his capital in West Beirut, and a forward base in South Lebanon, along the northern border with Israel. And Arafat was using South Lebanon as basically as a launching pad to launch terrorist attacks into Israel. And the Christians became increasingly disgruntled about this, and they started to form militias to take care of the Palestinians themselves, because the government wasn't going to do it. So what sparked the civil war were clashes in Beirut between Christian militias and Arafat's PLO, with the government basically stepping aside. And the government disintegrated, and 15 years of war ripped the country apart. Now, in 1982, the Israelis, well, first, the Israelis invaded briefly in 1978, but they invaded again more seriously in 1982 to get the Palestinian Liberation Organization off Israel's northern border. And the Israelis went all the way to Beirut to shut down Arafat's capital in West Beirut. That was one of the reasons the Israelis came in. The other reason was because the Israelis had a political and military alliance with some of the Christian militias. So the Israelis wanted to assist the Christians in Lebanon and prop up Bashir Gemayel, who was a Maronite Christian who was elected president of Lebanon. He hadn't been actually taken office yet. He was elected. Unfortunately, he was assassinated. A bomb blew him up in his headquarters while he was giving a speech. He was assassinated by a member of the Syrian Social Nationalist Party. And so after this, the Israeli alliance with Christians disintegrated. The Israelis did, however, manage to get Arafat's PLO exiled out of Lebanon and shipped over to Tunisia, where they were basically harmless. They're too far away from Israel to cause any trouble. But when the Israelis invaded in 1982, the Iranians suddenly took interest in Lebanon for the first time. They weren't really paying much attention to Lebanon before because they had just had the revolution in 1979 against the Shah. And the three factions in the Iranian revolution, the liberals, the leftists, and the communists, the liberals, the leftists, and the Islamists, were battling it out for who's going to control the Iranian government. And the Islamists came out on top and quickly found themselves in a war with Saddam Hussein's Iraq next door. But when Israel invaded in 1982, the Islamic Republic regime in Iran dispatched 1,500 commanders from battlefields in the Iran-Iraq war and sent them to Lebanon's Bekaa Valley, the eastern half of the country, along the border with Syria, to mobilize militant guerrilla cells to fight the Israelis in the south. And by 1982, these militant cells and various radical Shiite Islamic groups came together under, it started out more like an umbrella organization, but eventually became much more hierarchical, what we call Hezbollah today. At first they called themselves Islamic Jihad. The Islamic Jihad organization, which was not really a formal organization. By the time they coalesced into a single entity, they called themselves Hezbollah, Hez meaning party in Arabic, Allah meaning God. So Hezbollah is the party of God. It was founded, created, armed, trained, and funded by the Islamic Republic regime in Iran. But Hezbollah is also assisted by the government next door in Syria for a couple of reasons. One, because Syria is Iran's junior partner, its sidekick, so to speak. So Syria is going to help out Iran with whatever it wants to do, but also because Hezbollah is useful for the government in Damascus for two reasons. One, because Hezbollah can fight Israel from a distance. From the point of view of Syria, they can use Hezbollah as a proxy against Israel. Syria can get credit in the Arab world for resisting Israel without actually having to absorb any punishment for it, because anytime the Israelis shoot back, they're shooting back at Lebanon instead of at Syria. So Assad basically gets to have his cake and eat it. Hezbollah is also useful because it provides a check against the government in Beirut. So it works out very well for the Syrians. Now the Israelis, they entered Lebanon in 1982 to get rid of Arafat's state within a state. And they ended up having to stay in South Lebanon because all of a sudden they're being attacked by radical Shiites. Arafat's PLO is Sunni, and Israel didn't have any problem from the Shias in Lebanon until after they came in 1982, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps went in and started stirring up the Shias. So they went in to get rid of the Sunnis, and they ended up staying to keep the Shias off the border. And they kept a military force in South Lebanon for 18 years, from 1982 until 2000. They fought a slow-motion counterinsurgency against Hezbollah guerrillas in the south. And they left in 2000, they left very abruptly, without really coordinating with anybody, without even telling their allies in Lebanon that they were leaving. They just up and left very quickly. And they were hoping, when they left South Lebanon, the Lebanese army was going to take their place and keep their northern border secure. And it didn't work out that way. Hezbollah fighters flooded the zone and took over the vacuum that was left by the withdrawing Israeli military. So they basically set up their own little state within a state in South Lebanon, just like the PLO did. So the Israelis ended up, over a period of 18 years, inadvertently swapping out a PLO state within a state on the northern border for a Hezbollah state within a state on the northern border. And Hezbollah is much more powerful, much more dangerous than the PLO ever has been. As we all saw in 2006, when Hezbollah fighters killed 3 Israeli soldiers and kidnapped 2, and took those 2 across the border, and sparked the 2006 war in July. Israel responded by hitting not only Hezbollah positions in South Lebanon, but also Lebanese infrastructure. They destroyed bridges in the south. They put holes in the runway at the international airport, and they did this presumably because they did not want Hezbollah to take their kidnapped soldiers out of the country, or they wouldn't be able to rescue them. And Hezbollah responded by firing thousands of rockets, World War II era Katyusha rockets, into northern Israel. Now, I actually saw this war from the Israeli side. I was living in Beirut, but I was in Iraq when the war started, and I wasn't able to get to Lebanon to cover it from the Lebanese side. So I had to cover it from the Israeli side. I flew to Tel Aviv, rented a car with my friend and colleague, Noah Pollack. We drove from Tel Aviv up to northern Israel in August of 2006. And I felt like one of the stupidest people on the face of the earth for driving up to this border area, because everybody else had already left. Anybody with any sense who lived in Israel, in the northern sixth of the country, which was under constant daily rocket attack, had already left. The only people who were still up there were the Israeli military, a few police officers, and a couple of civilians. I don't know what they were thinking, but they were still up there, and some journalists, and there was nobody else there. It was like a scene in a Hollywood movie set in the end of the world. I mean, there were no people up there, there were no cars, and the cities were on fire, and there was smoke in the air, and air raid sirens were going off constantly, and Hezbollah rockets were exploding randomly because they couldn't be aimed. They're exploding all over the place. Now, this is what Hezbollah was able to do in 2006. They were able to create almost 1 million refugees in Israel and make the entire northern sixth of the country virtually uninhabitable. I mean, I was up there for a while, and a few other people were up there, but it was not possible to live under these conditions. It's just not possible. I mean, the entire northern sixth of the country was basically shut off. And since then, since 06, Hezbollah is much more powerful than it was, has twice as many rockets and missiles as it did during the war 5 years ago. It has actually more rockets and missiles than most national armies in the world. And it's a terrorist organization that is well equipped, certainly better equipped than the Lebanese army. I mean, the Lebanese army would lose a stand-up fight with Hezbollah immediately. And their rocket range is also much longer now. In 06, they could only hit the northern sixth of the country. And today, they have missiles that can reach all the way down to the tourist resort of Eilat on the Red Sea. They can hit the entire country. They can hit Tel Aviv. They can hit Jerusalem. They probably wouldn't, but they could. And they can hit the Dimona nuclear power plant. Now, I don't know how many of you have been to Tel Aviv. I've been to Tel Aviv. I've spent a lot of time there. This is a city that is like Miami of the Middle East. They've got these shiny glass skyscrapers on the beach over the Mediterranean. And if Hezbollah's got missiles crashing into the sides of these shining glass skyscrapers, the Israelis are without doubt going to fight back much harder, much faster than they did in 2006, when they really only needed to protect the northern six of the country, which had already been basically emptied of civilians anyway. I mean, the number of Israeli civilians killed during that war was relatively small because most of them just left. They got out of rocket range. But if there's another war like the last one, well, it won't be like the last one. Because the major population centers, I mean, the overwhelming majority of Israelis live in or around the Tel Aviv area. And there won't be anywhere for them to go if there is a repeat, anything like the last war. And another war between Israel and Hezbollah could easily draw in the Syrians and the Iranians for a couple of reasons. One, because another war with Hezbollah might actually start not by Hezbollah this time, but by Israel striking Iran's nuclear weapons facilities. If Israeli intelligence believes that the Iranians are actually on the cusp of developing nuclear weapons, and they're going to go through with it, and nothing else that the West has tried to do to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons, they very well may launch a military strike on the Iranian weapons facilities. I don't know if they're going to do this. I don't even know if they can do it, but my guess is that they probably would do it, and that they probably can, or if they're not sure, that they will try. And if so, Hezbollah is almost certain to fire off its rocket and missile arsenal at the Israelis. And I think this is the reason why the Israelis want to wait until the last minute and not use military force against Iran's nuclear weapons facilities, is because they're afraid of what's going to happen, what's going to be coming at them from Lebanon. And so, under that scenario, you would right away have three countries at war at the same time. You'd have Israel, Iran, and Lebanon. I would be a little bit surprised if the Syrians didn't get drawn in, either because the Syrians would pile on, because they might feel that they might actually be able to have a good showing against Israel finally, now that Israel is bogged down in Lebanon and in Iran at the same time. And it's also entirely possible that the Israelis would widen the war to include Syria, because Syria is a critical logistics hub between Iran and between Hezbollah. So it wouldn't really take too much for all four of these countries to be involved in a war at the same time. And if this happens, it wouldn't take too much more for the United States to get dragged in. Whether we like it or not, I mean, we are Israel's ally, the only real ally Israel has in the world. We're tied up with what the Israelis do. And one of the worst case scenarios for the Israelis and for us would be an Israeli strike on Iran's nuclear weapons facilities that fails, which could actually happen if Israel is forced to fend off attacks from Iran, from Syria, from Lebanon, and possibly from Gaza at the same time. And no matter who's in the White House, and no matter what they think of all this, we may easily end up getting dragged into this to make sure that if it's going to happen, that it happens right and that it gets finished. And of course, if the United States is drawn into a region-wide war, Iran has serious medium-range missiles with powerful payloads, and they can retaliate not against us here, but against American troops in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and bases in the Persian Gulf. I mean, it would be a worst-case scenario. I mean, I'm not predicting that this is actually going to happen, but it's a real possibility that there could be a war simultaneously involving the United States, Israel, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan. That's a worst-case scenario, but it's actually possible. So, why does Lebanon matter? Lebanon matters because it will be the epicenter. The Lebanese-Israeli border, because Hezbollah controls the northern side of it, has basically become the front line, the most serious front line, in the Arab-Israeli conflict. It's the front line in the Iranian-Israeli conflict, and it's the point where Iran is facing off and resisting, to use its word, the West in general, if we consider Israel a Western country, and I think we should. And we've got this Arab Spring sweeping the region, and also revolts in Iran at the same time trying to overthrow the government. But I am not personally optimistic that the Green Movement in Iran is going to succeed, because they've been trying for years to get rid of the government and have been failing. And there's a revolt in Syria against the Assad government, which I also think is likely to fail, because the Syrian government, like the Libyan government, is going to kill as many people as it thinks it has to stay in power. And nobody in the West or in Israel wants to do anything to Syria like NATO is doing in Libya, because of all the things that I've just talked about. The Syria's got powerful allies in Lebanon and Gaza and Iran, and nobody wants to go there. Gaddafi has no friends in the world, but Assad does. And so, unfortunately, as exhilarating as it may be to watch one Middle Eastern tyrant fall after another, I don't think that it's really going to have any effect on what I've just spent the last couple of minutes talking about. I'd like to be wrong, but I don't think I am. So, well, why don't we open this up for questions, discussion? Yes.
Who should do what?
Sorry?
Who should do what?
That is a really good question, and I do not know the answer. Oh, sure. Yeah, he said, who should do what? Well, if I were brought into the White House to ask for my advice, I would say to do everything short of war against the Syrian and Iranian governments right now. And as far as actually going beyond that, I wouldn't personally feel comfortable saying, yeah, the United States should do it, but maybe the United States should do it, and maybe the United States will do it. I think it's more likely that the Israelis will do it. I don't actually know, but it's not my job to say the U.S. should go to war or not go to war, the Israelis should or shouldn't. I feel more like it's my job to just analyze the situation and take a look at it. So I don't know. I don't want to go on record saying, yes, the U.S. should go to war against Iran. Although if it were to happen, I wouldn't get in the way. Just put it that way.
Roger, yes. Barbara,
okay.
I am not needed here because Michael's been doing it fine.
Well, what do you need me? If you're going to be...
I'm just going to call him. I just want to thank Michael for his excellent presentation. Charles.
Yeah, what prompted the abrupt vacuum
What prompted the abrupt vacuum in South Lebanon when Israel left? In 2000. Yeah, do you mean why did the Israelis leave?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the Israelis left because they were tired of being in Lebanon. They had been in Lebanon for 18 years, and the overwhelming majority of the Israeli citizens decided they didn't want to be there anymore. And they believed that they didn't think that they were going to suddenly have a peace treaty with Lebanon if they left. That would have been crazy. I don't think any of them actually believed that. But they did believe and hope that the Lebanese army was going to control the border, like the other Middle Eastern national governments control their borders. And they were hoping that Beirut was going to do that, but they were wrong. It didn't happen because Hezbollah fighters flooded the zone and took over the area instead.
Anything could control the border and prevent the rockets coming in from Hezbollah.
Sorry.
Who did they think was going to prevent rockets from coming in to rearm Hezbollah?
They thought the Lebanese army was going to take care of security. Or remember, this was also the time when the Syrian government was occupying Lebanon, and Syria kept a quiet border between Israel and Syria, and so I guess they were also hoping that the Syrians would facilitate this, because they had more say in what went on in Lebanon than anybody else. But it didn't work out that way, because, I mean, Assad found it very useful to have this proxy militia messing with Israel on the border, but it wasn't actually in Syria, and he could sort of, you know, have plausible deniability.
But didn't they count on the UN as well?
I don't think they expected the UN to do anything. I mean, the UN had been there since 1978, but ineffectively. I don't think they really expected the UN to do much.
Bob?
Can you elaborate a little bit on what you think the Hezbollah political agenda is? Now, we know that they can shoot all these rockets into Israel, but obviously, as we know, there are limits to air power or rocket power. So even if they shot every single rocket into Israel, they're not going to occupy Israel.
Right.
So this is obviously a part of their agenda, but they must have other political elements in their agenda that are more fundamental than simply launching rockets into Israel. And maybe you can I've never heard what they're really trying to do in Lebanon.
Yes, he asked me what is Hezbollah's political agenda in Lebanon. Well, they have two levels to the political agenda. If they could get everything they wanted, they're smart enough to know they can't, But if they could get everything they wanted, they would turn Lebanon into what Iran is today. They want an Iranian-style regime in Beirut. But it's not possible. They know it's not possible because they will have to contend with an overwhelmingly hostile majority in Lebanon, not only from the Christian community and also the Sunni community, but from within their own Shia community. Because there are quite a number of Lebanese Shias who support Hezbollah right now for sectarian reasons. Because Hezbollah is a powerful Shia militia, and the Shias have historically been marginalized in Lebanon. They've been marginalized politically and economically. And Hezbollah is basically their revenge. And I know a number of atheist Lebanese Shias who support Hezbollah because they know that Hezbollah will never be able to turn Lebanon into Islamic State. And the minute Hezbollah actually tried to turn Lebanon into Islamic State, they will lose easily half of the support they have right now among the Shias, which would put their support base in the country down to about 12%, 15%. That would be all their support they would have. And they don't have, you can't use World War II era rockets to govern a country. I mean, it's a guerrilla army. And if they tried to take over the country, they would be fighting, instead of an insurgency, they would be fighting a counterinsurgency. And a guerrilla army can't really fight a counterinsurgency, so it's not realistic. They know that they cannot take over the entire country and turn it into another Iran. So in the meantime, what they basically want to do is just have as much power as practicable. And what they really want and need is to control Lebanon's foreign and internal security policy. And they've been able to do that, unfortunately.
Anything on this side?
No.
The Lebanese army, who's it composed of? Who makes it up? Who controls it? And does it have any chance whatsoever of playing any kind of effective role other than providing cover for the Hezbollah?
Hey, the Lebanese army is made up, on one hand, of conscripts. So it reflects basically the makeup of the country, because everybody has to serve in the Lebanese army for a couple of years. But at the officer level, it is much more aligned with Syria, because Syria occupied the country for 15 years and basically sabotaged the Lebanese army, weakened it as much as possible, crippled it at the knees, and replaced its top-level officer corps with Damascus loyalists. And these people have not been purged. I mean, they still have their jobs. The Syria appointed them, the top levels of the army. So, not the entire army is pro-Syrian by any means, but a significant percentage of the officer class is, more than would be naturally and organically. But because the army is made up of conscripts, a majority of the Shia soldiers they support Hezbollah politically, and so if they're in the army, their sympathies are more with Hezbollah than with the national government in Beirut. And so if the army was actually ordered, first of all, there's nobody in the army who would order soldiers to fight and disarm Hezbollah. There's nobody there to do it. The Syrians took care of that. But if the army officer corps were to be purged of Damascus loyalists and the army was sent into battle against Hezbollah, the army would split. Soldiers who are more loyal to Hezbollah than to the Lebanese government would just leave the army, and it would split apart into mutually hostile factions. And that's exactly what happened during the Civil War. And everybody in Lebanon knows this is likely to happen. So the Lebanese army is basically useless. I mean, it doesn't engage in any fighting with anybody, except the only group of people that the Lebanese army can safely fight inside Lebanon are the Palestinians. There was a war in the Palestinian refugee camp of Nahr al-Bared in northern Lebanon some years ago. And nobody in Lebanon likes the Palestinians. I mean, the Palestinians get a lot of lip service in Lebanon, but nobody really actually likes the Palestinians. And so when this al-Qaeda-like group emerged from this Palestinian refugee camp, well, the Lebanese army could go in there and deal with that because there was nobody in the Lebanese army who was really sympathetic with the Palestinians or with these al-Qaeda-like people in the camp. So the army was actually useful then against that particular threat, but it's completely useless when it comes to dealing with anything else, unfortunately.
Linda.
Lebanon get involved if another intifada breaks out?
She asked if Lebanon would get involved if another intifada breaks out. I doubt it, personally, but I don't know. I haven't actually thought about that question before.
Well,
It's a good question. I don't know. I won't make up an answer for Denny to know.
How about instead of the Lebanon and Hezbollah? Would they get involved with any kind of program?
That's kind of what I assumed that she meant, Hezbollah. I'm certain that the Lebanese government would have nothing to do with another Palestinian intifada. What I'm not sure about is the if Hezbollah would. I kind of doubt it, but I don't know. It's possible.
There have been news reports recently of people from refugees from Syria crossing the border into Lebanon. It doesn't sound like they'd be any safer there than they would in their own country.
No, they're not. And actually, some Syrian soldiers tried to defect. They were guarding the Lebanese-Syrian border, and they were trying to protect refugees that were fleeing violence in Syria into Lebanon. And they got in a shooting war with militia loyal to the government of Damascus. And they knew they were in serious trouble, so they tried to defect to Lebanon. But defecting to Lebanon from Syria right now would be like trying to defect from Moscow to East Berlin during the Cold War. I mean, the foreign and internal security policy in Beirut is entirely dictated by Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah, so there's no one to defect to in Lebanon. So that didn't work out very well for those soldiers who tried to defect. And the Lebanese army arrested them almost at once. I'm not sure what happened to them, but they were deported. And I would be surprised if they weren't executed. And they certainly would disappear into a dungeon somewhere.
Yes, I'm just staring at how sad is a member of the Alawite minority. And as such, how much support does he have among his people?
She said, because Assad is a member of the Alawite minority, how much support does he have in the people of Syria? Well, he has support among the Alawite minority because they only make up 10 or 12% of the population. And they managed to seize power through the Assad government. So, I mean, a lot of the Alawites at the lower level of society don't benefit from this system at all, whereas some of the rich Sunnis do. But nevertheless, their interests, their sectarian interests, are protected by the government, because almost everybody at the top levels of the government, the military, the internal security services, and the bureaucracy, all from the Alawite community. There are actually others in Syria who support the current government, not because they like the current government, because they're afraid of what comes after. And probably a lot of Christians support the current government for that reason, because they do, I think, have reason to be afraid of a radical Sunni Muslim Brotherhood type regime replacing the current government. I think the Christians and the Alawites actually would fare worse under a Muslim Brotherhood government than the current government. And they know it, and so Assad does have some support from these people. But it's not the majority of the country by any means. But all dictators have some support, and this would be where his base is. Also, people who just fear chaos. I mean, there will be Sunnis who are afraid of what comes next, because before the current government took over, there was one coup after another. Syria was a complete, total disaster. And the only thing that you could really say about the current government is it brought stability to the country, but it did actually bring stability to the country. So that would be another group of Syrians who support the current government for that reason.
We have one patient question.
To what extent does the Christians and the Sunnis exert restraint on the militancy and the setting off of rockets by Hezbollah, since everyone knows that the Israelis are going to retaliate at a very high level, and that the entire Lebanese society will suffer? So aren't those two groups a restraint on the activism, if you will, of Hezbollah?
Yeah, he asked if the Lebanese Sunnis and Christians have much of a ability to restrain Hezbollah, knowing that Israeli counterstrikes will be devastating. I think the answer is some, but an insufficient amount. I mean, if the Christians and the Sunnis decide they want to band together and do something to stop Hezbollah, well, what are they going to do? I mean, there's not really anything they can do, because they used to have militias that could counter Hezbollah, but they don't anymore, because when Syria took over the country in 1990 and shut down the civil war, Syrians shut down all the militias in the country except for Hezbollah, because Hezbollah was useful to the Syrians, but Assad disarmed everybody else. So, and as far as I know, the Sunnis, the Druze, and the Christians have not been reconstituting their old militias. They keep threatening to do it, and there are some of them who want to do it, but they haven't actually done it, and the Lebanese army is useless, so Hezbollah could just basically say, yeah, okay, so you don't like it, but well, you know, what are you going to do about it? Nothing. They can't really do anything about it. So I think their ability to restrain Hezbollah is very limited and almost non-existent.
Yes, ma'am.
Michael, would you be willing to venture a subjective percent probability that Israel or somebody will take out Iranian's nukes before they are deployed? And if not, what scenario do you envision?
She asked if I could guess what's the likelihood of Israel doing something about Iran's nuclear weapons program. I would say, and I'm just guessing, okay? It's just a gut level hunch. I would put it greater than 50%. But I don't know. I mean, really, I don't know. And nobody knows. I mean, Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic spent months interviewing one Israeli military and intelligence and political figure after another, like over 100 of them, and asked them basically what you just asked me. And he said, well, more than half of them thought that Israel would do something about Iran's nuclear weapons facilities, but a large minority of them said that no, that they're not going to do anything. So, and Israel probably doesn't really know if they're going to do anything about it either. As far as the second part of your question, what will it mean if Iran does develop nuclear weapons? I'm not of the school that believes that Iran intends to nuke Israel. I don't think that's going to happen. But I'm not entirely sure that that's not going to happen. I mean, I don't believe that in the same way that I believe that France won't nuke Israel. I mean, we all know France has nuclear weapons, but nobody worries that Paris is going to nuke Tel Aviv. It's just not going to happen. It doesn't even occur to anybody to worry about this. But it does occur to people to worry that Iran might actually do it. I don't think they would, but I don't know that. And it's entirely possible that Iran will develop this nuclear weapons, not because they want to nuke Israel, but because they just want to have it, which is what I think they want. They just want to have it. It will make them stronger. But they might end up firing the thing off anyway in some future war down the road where they don't expect or intend to use it, but they might end up doing it anyway if they get in a war and they feel like they're about to lose power. I mean, Israel, India and Pakistan have come close to nuking each other a couple of times. I don't think either one of those countries developed nuclear weapons with the intention of destroying their neighbor, but twice they almost did it. So, it could happen. But I believe that Iran just wants it because it wants the bomb because it wants to be the regional hegemon. And I think that it would achieve that goal with nuclear weapons because all the Arab countries that are afraid of Iran and dislike Iran for various reasons, the Sunni-Shia conflict, Arabs and Persians don't like each other, they've got geopolitical reasons to not like each other, who's going to dominate the Gulf? I mean, there's lots of reasons why they don't like each other. But these Arab countries are not going to have much choice but to accommodate Iran if Iran has nuclear weapons. But yeah, Iran would be calling far more shots than it does today. And I think that's why they want the bomb.
Way in the back, hello.
Yes, could you please tell us a little bit about your book and why you chose the name The Road to Fatima Gate?
Yes, why I chose the name The Road to Fatima Gate. I chose it because, well, first of all, Fatima Gate is it's an old border crossing on the Lebanese-Israeli border that was open when Israel controlled both sides of the border, but it's closed now. But I chose that title just because I like the sound of it, but also because this book it's a first-person narrative account. It's not dry policy analysis. It's told from my point of view, and I wrote it as much as I could like a novel. And if you were to hear the title, The Road to Fatima Gate, not knowing anything about the book, you might think it sounds like the title of a novel, where it's not the kind of title like Hezbollah Explained or anything like this that would really only appeal to regional specialists and people who have to read the book because it's their job to read the book. I didn't want to write a book like that. I didn't write a book like that. And I wanted my title to at least subconsciously convey that. So that's why I picked it.
Jimmy, I want to put in a little plug.
If you were to be able to get back into Lebanon today, would you find your movements closely curtailed? I mean, you develop a relationship with many different Lebanese, all different factions and groups, and we're just wondering what it would be like for you at this point if you could possibly go back.
Yeah, he asked if my movement would be curtailed if I were to go back to Lebanon today. I could go to Lebanon tomorrow, and my movement would not be curtailed except in the areas that Hezbollah controls. But that's always been true. Nobody can move freely in Hezbollah-controlled parts of the country. I mean, it's a little totalitarian police state. But the rest of the country is like civilized anarchy. I mean, there's almost no police presence. There's no red lights, no stop signs. I mean, the place is crazy. It's amazing that it manages to function. And there's also almost no crime. There's like no police and no crime. It's very bizarre. You can do whatever you want. It's like it's a libertarian's paradise, except that insofar as you feel no power of the state bearing down on you whatsoever. But the problem with this, of course, is the state is so weak that Hezbollah can rise up and do whatever it wants. But if I were to go to Beirut tomorrow, and I could do whatever I want in the Christian parts of the country, the Sunni parts of the country, the Jewish parts of the country, nobody's going to get in my way. Nobody's going to spy on me. In the Hezbollah parts of the country, I wouldn't have any more freedom than if I was in Syria.
I would just like to point out that Michael's excellent book is on sale in the back there, and it's been very, very well received and well reviewed. Yes, ma'am.
On the possibility that beyond all this terrible facility, Israel is conducting some secret talks with some of these arch enemies?
Which arch enemies are you referring to? Like Iran and Syria? I doubt that the Israelis are conducting any talks with Hezbollah. I doubt it very much. I'd be very surprised to learn that. There are people in Israel who want to open talks with the Syrian government because they believe that Assad might actually sign a peace treaty. I think they're mistaken, but they do believe that. And sometimes the Syrian government goes through the motions of pretending to have real negotiations with Israel because it gives them PR points in the West. So that's possible, that at some low or medium level, that Israelis and Syrians are talking. Although I doubt it at the moment, with what's going on in Syria, that the Syrian government is going to be bothered with this. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Syrian government manages to maintain its hold on power by killing however many hundreds of thousands of people it has to, that it's going to reopen negotiations with Israel to make itself look a little more reasonable and moderate and civilized than it is. And there are people on the Israeli side who would be willing to go along with that. Iran? Doubt it. I doubt there's any talk at all between the two countries, but I don't know. I mean, it could be going on, but I'm not aware of it, and I would be surprised to learn about it.
Any other questions?
Yes. Yes. Are you familiar with what the effects of the cyber attacks and Iran's nuclear capability?
He asked if I'm familiar with the effects of the cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear weapons facilities, and I don't know any more than what's in the newspapers about that. And I don't even know if what we're reading in the newspapers is accurate. I really have no idea. And I don't know if anybody really knows. I mean, it's probably designed by the Israelis, but I don't know if there's any way for them to even monitor what it's doing to Iran's systems. Because I really have no idea. I can only guess. I wish I did know, because it's fascinating.
You mentioned these factions that exist. Are there peaceniks? Are there people who want to, you know, in other words, what are the, I know what the question is. How does the country divide up between very pro and very anti, and what do they want?
She asked if there are peaceniks in Lebanon. I presume you mean Lebanon, right?
Yeah.
And how these different political factions divide and what they want. Yes, there are peaceniks in Lebanon. It may be the only Arab country where there are people that you would describe that way. But there are people like this in Lebanon. They tend to be Christians for the most part. I mean, the Christian community in Lebanon is a lot, you could think of them almost as Westerners. And they have the same kind of political divisions amongst themselves that Christians have in Western countries, including peaceniks, and including from the hard right all the way to the hard or soft left. There are also people who you, I wouldn't describe as peaceniks in the Sunni and Shia communities, but there are quite a lot who are really not interested in more war with Israel. That doesn't mean they're peaceniks in the way that we think of them. They're not going to march in the streets waving the peace sign, but if you ask them if they want to go to war with Israel again, they'll say absolutely not, regardless of what they think about Israel. I mean, a lot of them genuinely, the majority of Lebanese really don't like Israel at all, but that doesn't mean that they're interested in more war with Israel. The number of people who actually want to go to war is a minority, for sure.
The only thing is, what is their economic status? How do they, you know, the living, the people who live there?
She asked about the economic status, how standard of living. It varies. The average monthly salary in Lebanon is only $800 a month, but everything's cheaper. So, it's not like trying to live in Manhattan on $800 a month. I mean, rent is much cheaper, food is cheaper, everything's cheaper. And people also tend to live with a larger number of people per household. So they have, it's not like the nuclear family in the U.S. where you've got mom, dad, and two kids. They'll have often two or even three generations living in the same house, and they can pool all these incomes together and make an income that's more sizable. So it really depends. There's a lot of money sloshing around the country, a huge amount. There's a lot of poverty and a lot of incredible wealth, and the average person is somewhere in the middle, like what we would think of as below the level of middle class, but not wretched conditions like what you get in Egypt and a lot of other places in the region.
We have time for a couple more if anyone has any questions left. Gene.
In view of the disarray in Syria, what with these street protests there, how do you think Syria is figuring in your calculations as almost a catalyst for future outbreak of conflict?
Syria is a catalyst for conflict. I mean, Syria is a country that is inherently unstable. Like Lebanon and Iraq, it's fractured by sectarian divisions. And you've got roughly a tenth, a little more, the country's Alawite, another tenth or so is Christian. You've got a bunch of Druze and Kurds, and you've got Sunnis, which make up the majority, but not a huge overwhelming majority. And the country has, before the Ba'ath Party took over, was incredibly unstable. And so one thing the current government does is basically exports its own internal instability. It destabilizes Lebanon, Israel, Iraq. It used to seriously mess with the Turks until the Turkish government said, if you don't stop, we're going to come and invade and destroy your government. So the Syrians said, oh yeah, all right. And they haven't messed with the Turks ever since. But yeah, Syria basically exports its instability. And if the government were to fall, I think Syria would revert to being extraordinarily unstable internally, but it would stop applying all of this negative pressure on its neighbors. So it should be in our interest to see a new government in Syria. For that reason.
Hello, did
you? Let me ask one more question. Go ahead. Saudi Arabia hasn't been discussed. Some years ago, they were a major factor in Lebanon. They aren't any longer. But they are still a major factor regarding Iran and the entire Middle East. How do you figure a Saudi Arabia in this entire equation?
You asked me about Saudi Arabia and how it figures into this entire equation. Saudi Arabia is a really complicated place. I don't fully understand it. Never been there. I do know that the Saudis are extremely opposed to Iran's regional foreign policy and extremely opposed to Iran's nuclear weapons program. And it's a bit of an open secret that the Saudis would let the Israelis stop and land there and refuel on their way to Iran on a mission to shut down Iran's nuclear weapons facilities. And the Saudis would deny it, of course, and, you know, denounce the Zionists for bombing a fellow Muslim nation, but nobody would buy it. I mean, I think everybody in the region at least knows that the Saudis are far more concerned about the Persian Shias than they are about the Jewish Zionists. And they feel more threatened by Iran. I mean, the Saudis know that Israel's not actually going to mess with them, because Israel never has. But the Iranian government's messing with them right now and has been doing so all along and is going to continue to do so even more if it gets the bomb. So, I mean, it's not too hard to believe, I don't think, that the Saudis will be quietly cooperating with these Israelis if push comes to shove.
Hello, did you have another?
I will ask, my question was, you mentioned the disarray or the lack of usefulness of the Lebanese army on more than one occasion. And yet, maybe you can give us some details on this. The American government has been, at least until recently, and maybe it's changed, I don't know, has been helping to supply, arm, and train the Lebanese army. And yet, from all the discussion you've made over here, we're wasting our time, we're wasting our money. Are we still continuing to support them in any way, shape, or form? And when we were doing it, were we doing it out of ignorance, or were we doing it just basically to sort of like push the problem away to a side by trying to find a different expedient way of quieting down the situation?
The Iraqi army had similar problems that the Lebanese army has today, and the U.S. was able to overcome most of those problems in the Iraqi army, but with constant, really close cooperation and training. But there are some differences. The Iraqi army was actually faced with fighting active counterinsurgency in Iraq, unlike the Lebanese army in Lebanon. So the Iraqi army had the same problems where it was divided by sect. And if the Iraqi army was sent against Shia militias, a lot of the Shias in the army would defect from the army and join their brethren in the militias. And this happened over and over and over again, one round after another. But eventually, the Iraqi army got better because the people who wanted to defect from the army and join a militia had already done it. And so they were able to basically purge all these people out of the army after one round after another of this sort of thing in places like Baghdad. And I think the U.S. is just hoping for a similar outcome in Lebanon with an army that has a similar problem. But what actually fixed the Iraqi army, which was constant close cooperation with Americans and actually fighting alongside Americans and having one round of purges after another because people volunteered themselves out of the Iraqi army, the ones who were not loyal to the state, none of this is happening in Lebanon. And it's not going to happen in Lebanon. So I think, personally, it's probably a waste of time with what the U.S. is doing. We're still doing it, yeah, and I think just hoping for the same kind of result that we got in Iraq without quite thinking about how we got that result in Iraq. And so I think it's a waste. I don't think it's particularly harmful because the Lebanese army doesn't really do anything. The Lebanese army is certainly not going to start shooting at us anytime soon. So I don't think it's necessarily bad, but I do think it's probably a waste of time. Not gonna really achieve much.
Did you want to? It's the last question.
Oh, well, you don't have time.
No. Go on. It's the last one.
Okay. I know you don't think this is going to happen, but if the Syrian government were overthrown, do you think it would be chaos, or do you think it would be the Muslim Brotherhood, or what would you imagine?
She asked what I imagine the Syrian government's overthrown. I would expect chaos. The Muslim Brotherhood could take over, but I think it's much more likely in Egypt for that to happen than in Syria. In Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood has a lot of built-in obstacles that it can never overcome. It's got the Alawites, 12% of the country, are not going to go along with the Muslim Brotherhood. The Christians aren't going to go along with it. The Druze aren't going to go along with it. Liberal Sunnis aren't going to go along with it. Anyone who's a secular-minded person in the Sunni community is not going to go along with it.
The Kurds?
The Kurds aren't going to go along with it. And not even all religious Muslims are going to go along with it. So, I mean, the number of people who would actually support the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria is much less than in Egypt. So it would have a much harder time. And they also don't have any organization. In Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood's been really well organized for a very long time. And in Syria, they don't have anything. So I wouldn't be too worried about the Muslim Brotherhood taking over Syria. It could happen. I'm not saying it's impossible. It could happen, but I wouldn't worry about it too much. And I would expect chaos instead. I mean, it'd be pretty ugly in Syria, I think. But the problem, the Syrian problems would, I think, become more of a local problem for Syrians rather than for Lebanon, Israel, Iraq, and anybody else that Syria has been messing with lately.
Well, we had promised it would end at 1:30, and it's 1:31. I want to thank Michael for an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
And he may stick around for a couple of minutes if anyone has a pressing question. And he's got these books in the back there that are also excellent.
Yeah, I can sign books. Michael?